It's been quite some time since 9/11. Quite some time since that turmoil that reminded us again of something that is very ancient in our bones, in our heritage, in our culture, in our civilizations, that remind us that there is division. And yet at the same time, there is unity. There is a call to come together and a call that reminds us of fear and the need to protect ourselves. It's an interesting question how we have done in that time to learn and grow so that we might be able to provide ourselves, one another in this world, with that sense that we are all one. So this morning is a test to see how we're doing. It's a hypothetical chance to see how Unitarian Universalism calls us to act in a fearful and conflict-ridden world. Here are the circumstances that I would like you to imagine that are part of your life. They are centered around five hypothetical suppositions. Supposition one, you work for a Division of Homeland Security, which oversees commercial aviation. Your job is to study the reservation lists for international carriers and identify possible passengers who are security threats and then recommend their detention or arrest, and if necessary, to cancel flights. Supposition two, one of the passengers of a major airliner has a name Tariq Ramadan. You've pulled up his file and you have learned this. He is a Muslim with published CIA documents which include phrases such as known radical and terrorist threat. He's an academic and has written much commentary that has gone all over the world, predominantly in Islamic countries, about the Quran and about the negative stereotypes cast by Western culture. You have a picture of Mr. Ramadan. It shows a man with dark complexion. He is unshaven, no smile. You notice also that Mr. Ramadan's flight from Geneva to New York City is set to take off in 8 hours. Supposition three, you see that your daughter also holds a reservation on that same flight from Geneva to New York City. Supposition four, the security code for international travel as suggested by Homeland Security, the agency that you work for, went from yellow to orange that morning. Supposition five, your boss, who is a rather impatient, anal retentive sort, is coming down the hall because he wants to know if you have any reservations to suggest after he put that file on your desk. You have access to all the information you need, and you have the power to decide what happens next. The test before you asks, what do you do? How will Unitarian Universalism help you pass this test? During the interview in which you got the job, you let it slip out that you were a leader in your church. And when you said that, your boss gave you a smile of approval. You decided not to mention that you were Unitarian Universalist. But you are glad now that you have some background, some basis of moral principle that actually allows you to face so many of the ethical challenges that you encounter every day. You admit that upon reading Mr. Ramadan's file, you felt the immediate impulse to run screaming down the concourse and yank your child off the plane. From your first year on the job and the conversations that you've had so far in the lunchroom, you conclude that this strategy would probably be supported, if not encouraged, by many of your colleagues and may even be accepted as a professional standard in the Homeland Security Handbook. But you're pretty sure that running down the concourse and screaming in airports probably isn't one of the seven principles and purposes. You look at the large thermometer above your desk indicating national terror alert. It is orange, almost red. You've struggled with that sign ever since you started working there. You've been told that it's about preparedness, but sometimes it feels more about keeping people afraid, prompting us to be more reactive, more suspicious, even paranoid. Why is it always so high, you wonder? Your boss comes into your office and asks if you have any changes. Part of you initially wants to say yes. Part of you wants to alert your boss to Mr. Ramadan's file and take your child off that plane, whatever. Another part of you, though, wants to say no, doesn't want to give in to reactionary fear. But you feel the pressure to make a quick decision on limited circumstantial information, and that seems so prejudicial. So you muster up the courage to tell your very important boss to come back in 15 minutes. He's not happy, but he concedes. You use the time to Google Tariq Ramadan, and you discover that he is considered a leader in the Islamic community, a professor of Islamic studies specializing in religion and philosophy. He's lectured at Oxford and Kyoto and Holland and Brussels. He was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most important innovators of the 21st century. And he was recently named the Luce Professor of Religion, Conflict, and Peacebuilding at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. Very curious, you think, but is he a threat to security? You also read that Ramadan is the grandson of Hassan al-Banna, the man who in 1928 founded the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, probably the single most powerful Islamist institution of the 20th century. You know that some accuse the Brotherhood of having ties to extremism, but it's hard to untangle those accusations from all of the anti-Muslim prejudice. You pull up an article taken from Tariq Ramadan's comments at the Parliament of World Religions in Barcelona in 2004. The address begins by his quotation of the 49th chapter of the Quran, which says, "O humankind, we created you from male and female and made you into tribes and nations that you may know each other, not that you would grow to despise each other." You read Ramadan's comments on that passage, and he writes, "Knowing the other, those who are different from us, is a process that is unavoidable if fear of difference is to be overcome and mutual respect is to be attained. Human beings live within a test which they can and must master by making the effort to know and recognize those who are not of their tribe, or of their country, or their race, or their religion. Dialogue, particularly interreligious dialogue, is crucial." This seems peaceful, you think, but there is more. You see that Ramadan recently published a new piece entitled "The Manifesto for a New We," and you begin reading a part which talks about terrorism. The situations of Muslims in Western societies has for the last 20 years been fraught with difficulty, he says. If anything, this situation has worsened since the war against terror. Repeated terrorist attacks throughout the world and increased tensions stemming from social, economic, and immigration issues have combined to portray Islam and Muslims as a threat to the societies in the West. Fear and its accompanying social skittishness has become a part of the public mindset. Such reactions, while sometimes legitimate and understandable, are also being exploited with increasing frequency by Western governments for political gain. Suddenly, you begin to understand how the government might see Mr. Ramadan as a threat. And you read more. Muslims must rise, he says. They must grow in confidence, in clarity, in values, in numbers, in their ability to communicate the serenity of the faith of Islam in Western societies. The revolution of trust for which we appeal will depend on our ability to reappropriate our own heritage and to develop toward it some positive regard. We must stress social goodwill and civil accountability. We must emphasize the Islamic focus on introspection and self-reform. The policies of those who profit from mounting fear, he continues, can create precisely what they claim to combat. By perpetually accusing Muslims of not being integrated, of setting themselves apart, of setting up barriers of us and them, the intellectuals and the politicians spread suspicion, create divisions, and try to isolate Muslims. If there is a contribution that Muslim Westerners can bring to their respective societies, it is reconciliation. Our societies are awaiting the emergence of a new we, a we that would bring together men and women, citizens of all religions and those without religion, who would undertake together to resolve the contradictions of their society, the right to work, to housing, to respect, to take up the struggle against racism and all forms of discrimination, all offenses against human dignity. Such a we would be a creator and defender of pluralism in our greater global community. End quote. Suddenly, you are startled by your boss, who is now standing over your shoulder in your office. He sees the file on your desk and Ramadan's name circled. He sees you reading the article and he looks at you very expectantly. And you tell him that you found something that needs a little bit more research. He grumbles. You have to be able to make a decision if lives are on the line, he says brusquely, and he walks out. You can feel the expectation to identify Ramadan as a problem, but he doesn't seem like a problem. It also sounds like he is talking about a different religion than what you have been hearing about in your public conversations. You wonder why such fear and stigma surrounds Muslims. The car bombings, the suicide attacks, where does all that anger come from if it isn't really just an integral part of that religion? You realize that you don't know very much about Islamic religion. World religions is one of the sources of wisdom within Unitarian Universalism, and you've heard a good bit about Judaism and Buddhism and Taoism, even humanism in your Unitarian Universalist church, but you can't ever remember hearing very much about Islam. You think about your church and even your denomination. There is no UUs for Muslim awareness or the Muslim fellowship or the U covenant of Muslims. The hymnal only has a couple selections adapted from the Muslim tradition, and you don't ever remember your minister preaching on it. And yet, as you Google it, you discover that Islam is the second largest and arguably the fastest growing religion in the United States. soon to surpass Judaism. You discover it has 1.2 billion followers worldwide. It is the dominant religion in 56 countries and a major religious presence in almost every other country. You learn, contrary to what you thought, that less than 20% of Muslims are Arab. The majority of Muslims live in Asia or Africa, and the largest Muslim communities are in Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, Nigeria. Not one Arab country. You discover it is a religion composed of many different peoples and cultures and races and languages and ethnicities. You begin to understand the complex diversity within Islam, and you realize that although women in some Muslim societies are required to be fully covered in public and cannot drive cars and are sexually segregated in societies, women in many other Muslim societies wear a rich variety of clothing, drive cars, ride motorcycles, and are among the top students in universities. Indeed, women have served as prime minister or president of Muslim-dominated countries such as Turkey, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. You try to remember the last woman president of the United States or vice president. You look at the history of Islam and you discover that it came from the prophet Muhammad, who spoke of the one God, Allah. It was Muhammad that wrote the Quran, a book of God's doctrines, which spoke of God's power and goodness, the importance of prayer, the importance of humility and generosity, sharing wealth and privilege, especially with the poor and the weak. As Muhammad began to become recognized as a prophet, he was called to mediate skirmishes between tribes, eventually uniting them into one brotherhood. His abilities at dialogue and diplomacy became very influential in the religion of Islam. The meaning of Islam, you learn, comes from the Arabic letters S, L, and M, Salam, which means peace, or to surrender to God's unity, peacefulness, and goodness. Followers of Islam, or the path of surrender and peace, are known as Muslims. The religion, which formed in the 7th century, recognized Jews and Christians as kin, recognizing Abraham as a prophet, as well as recognizing Moses and Jesus as prophet. Muslims just didn't recognize them as divine, nor do they consider Muhammad to be divine. You discover that Muslims led the cultural movement for centuries in art and literature and science. They developed new theories of geology, of metals and magnetism. They developed the science of mathematics and gave the world the Arabic numeral system and the decimal system. They developed trigonometry and algebra. They published geographic encyclopedias, including the first complete map of the Eurasian continent, which inspired Columbus to explore the globe. They wrote authoritative works in medicine and pharmacology. They discovered the use of the pendulum and made clocks long before they were ever used in Europe. And they developed the use of public sanitation in the 9th and 10th centuries, 700 years before Christian Europe realized it was important to take baths. That's all good, you think, but if this is all true, what is all the violence about? What is the whole notion of this thing called jihad? You discover that jihad is a term which means to struggle in the way of God, or to struggle to improve oneself or one society. Its mention in the Quran is more about an internal battle to resist human temptations of power and greed. However, you discover that when Granada, Spain, one of the great centers of Muslim life, was conquered by Christians during their crusades, when all Muslims and Jews were forced to convert or flee or die, many Muslims began interpreting jihad as a physical holy struggle, even a call to military war. This interpretation surfaced during a time when Muslims were under the threat of having everything precious to them taken away, their life, their family, their land, their religion. And you think suddenly about the thought that you had earlier of wanting to run down the concourse screaming and clutch your child because it felt like something precious to you was in danger. As repulsive as religious extremism is, you can identify the desperation at the heart of it. The spiritual understanding of jihad talks about a war without internal, or a war that we have about internal desperation that leads to violence. The extremist version of jihad is simply succumbing to that violence. Your boss walks into your office, and now he wants an answer. Any changes? He demands impatiently. And you feel the impulse to do the right thing, to protect what is dear. And you also feel the duty and obligation to be loyal and do a good job. You also feel an obligation to be true to your country and your religion. This feels like a test, and you wonder, how should a Unitarian Universalist respond to this kind of test? The truth is that you already passed this test when you summoned the courage to tell your boss to wait while you researched and found out more information about this man and didn't judge him just on a few facts. You already passed this test when you felt the need to hear what Tariq Ramadan himself had to say. And you already passed this test when you opened your mind to try and understand the kind of world that would lead him to become the person that he was. The kind of person so rare as to hold people in power accountable. The kind of person who can point to a way beyond this black and white, impulsive, fear-based world. Any changes? Your boss growls. You look at the orange rating on the National Terror Alert poster above your desk. Yes, you reply. I have a change request. And you ask to have your child moved so that she can sit next to Tariq Ramadan. Because you realize that if any of us is ever going to rise above this terror, it will be because dialogue and learning becomes possible about our differences and helps us usher in that new we that he talks about. It will be only when, as Ramadan urges, we bring together men and women, citizens of all religions and those without religion, who would undertake together to resolve contradictions and conflicts of their society. Your boss is speechless, and when he does speak, he probably fires you. But it doesn't matter, because this is all a hypothetical situation. What is not hypothetical, however, is Tariq Ramadan and his relationship to Homeland Security. In August 2004, at the very time that I was in Istanbul, on the eve of his departure from Europe to America to move into his newly purchased home and to take his children to schools in which he enrolled them and take up the new professorship of peace studies at Notre Dame, his visa was revoked by the Department of State and Homeland Security. They said he had endorsed or espoused terrorism. No evidence was given. The international academic community was astonished, and after months of patient inquiry and stony silence on the part of the U.S. government, Ramadan finally had no alternative but to resign his professorship at Notre Dame His furniture and household belongings were sent back from South Bend to Geneva. Oxford University offered him a professorship in Islamic studies, and Ramadan went on to become an advisor to the British government. Friends, the situation I created here was hypothetical, but the test before us is real. It is a test to see if religion can become more than a comfort of the frightened masses. It is a test to see if religion can become a moral compass in the distribution of rights and resources around the globe. It is a test to see if our ethical principles, which are all too often relegated to religious sanctuaries, can offer a voice of accountability when the political offices speak of principles while waging war. There are several ways we can fail this test, either by allowing religion to dictate violence as Muslim extremists have done, or by allowing religion to remain complacent in the face of violence as is so often in the U.S. I ask you today to be ready for this test. It will come upon us soon. Indeed, it is already upon us. Our test of peacemaking will be graded by future generations, and the answer written in the back of the book of life will say, "We are all one. We are all just people together."